billions of dollars moved back and forth across the table. And I need to make sure that we have the best team at the table on Alaska's behalf. We have to bring our A team.
Governor Walker makes the case for huge salaries for the Alaska LNG project. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 17th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski urges hitting pause on bringing Syrian refugees to the U.S.
Let's put a stop on this right here, right now, until we can ascertain what the process is in place.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Another major oil company has announced it will exit Alaska's Arctic waters. Norwegian oil company Statoil said today it will end exploration efforts in the Chukchi Sea and close its Anchorage office. The decision comes just 2 months after Shell ended its quest to drill in the Arctic Ocean, citing disappointing results at its first well. Statoil spokesman Peter Simons says the Chukchi just didn't stack up against the company's other options worldwide.
Based on a number of different criteria, the leases in the Chukchi were considered not competitive within the global context.
He says that's in part because of the Arctic's difficult environment and high cost at a time of plunging oil prices. But Shell's exit also influenced the decision. Shell would have been an anchor tenant for the region, building out infrastructure that other companies could piggyback on.
That certainly would have enhanced the commerciality of our leases. So it certainly played a role.
Statoil owned 16 leases in the Chukchi Sea and shared ownership with ConocoPhillips on 50 others. It bought the leases for about $75 million in 2008, the same year Shell bought its leases. Shell was the only company to drill in the region, but Simons says Statoil conducted seismic and other studies. The leases expire in 2020, and earlier this fall, the Obama administration declined both Shell and Statoil's request to extend them, saying the companies had presented no concrete plans for exploration. Senators Lisa Murkowski and Dan Sullivan both issued statements blaming federal regulators for Statoil's decision, but Simons says it wasn't the main issue.
You know, the regulatory framework certainly has influenced, but it is not a primary driver. This is a commercial decision first and foremost.
Simons says the company has only 2 employees in its Anchorage office. Besides the Chukchi leases, the company has no other holdings in Alaska. Statoil still has active leases in Arctic waters off Russia and Greenland and is producing oil from an offshore site in Norway's Barents Sea. As the state prepares to take a larger role in the Alaska LNG gas line project, its leadership team is once again in flux. As APRN's Rachel Waldholtz reports, the changes are bringing new attention to the salaries involved, including one negotiator who has been paid about $120,000 per month since June.
Rigdon Boykin is a South Carolina-based attorney who's been serving as the state's lead negotiator on the Alaska LNG project. In that role, he's overseen discussions with the state's 3 main partners, ExxonMobil, BP, and ConocoPhillips, and coordinated among the alphabet soup of state agencies involved in the gas line. And for that work, he's been very well paid. Boykin isn't a state employee. As a consultant with the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, or AGDC, his contract calls for a salary of $120,000 a month from June through October and $100,000 for the month of November. The contract is capped at $850,000. In an interview last month, Governor Bill Walker said that's the price the state has to pay for expertise.
You know, we're negotiating a contract that Alaska will be bound to for probably 25, 30 years, and there'll be billions of dollars moved back and forth across the table, and I need to make sure that we have the best team at the table on Alaska's behalf. We have to bring our A team.
But now it seems Walker is reshuffling his A-team. After the Alaska Dispatch News reported last week that Boykin had traveled back to South Carolina, Walker released a statement saying he would recommend AGDC use Boykin in a different capacity going forward. It's not clear who, if anyone, will take his place. Miles Baker is AGDC's Vice President for External Affairs.
Our understanding is the administration wants to move back from sort of a lead negotiator approach to having the Attorney General's Office, Department of Law, Department of Revenue, and Department of Natural Resources collectively working on those agreements.
As for Boykin's pay, Baker says the contract isn't the norm for the state-owned corporation.
I would say this is at the very high end of the pay scale.
AGDC's president, Dan Fauske, is slated to make $366,000 plus benefits this year. For comparison, the governor makes $145,000 a year. Boykin's contract was negotiated by the governor's office. Spokesperson Katie Marquette said in an email that the rate is comparable to what past consultants on the gas line have made. Reached by phone, Boykin said he'd rather not comment. Meanwhile, the state has ended ties with another highly paid contractor, Texas oil and gas consultant Audie Setters. Setters was tasked with advising the state on the natural gas market and reaching out to potential buyers. The Department of Natural Resources estimates Setters' compensation at about $587,000 for 14 months of work. A department spokesperson said via email that the state has decided it needs a permanent employee in the role. The legislature approved funding for that position during the recent special session. The estimated salary? About $1.1 million a year, plus more than $300,000 in benefits. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
Alaska's congressmen and U.S. senators are among the chorus of political leaders calling on President Obama to cancel a plan to admit 10,000 Syrian refugees to the U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski says she wants a pause so Congress and the public can evaluate the vetting process. Murkowski says she knows screening a family can take up to 2 years, but she isn't clear on the details.
Until I know, I'm saying let's put a stop on this right here, right now, until we can ascertain what the process is in place.
Murkowski says the United States has a history of offering safety to refugees, and she doesn't want that generosity to disappear. But the senator says the phones in her office have been ringing off the hook, with Alaskans concerned about admitting Syrians because a terrorist might be hiding among the innocent.
I think that that's fair, because as generous and as hospitable as we want to be for others, we also want to be able to ensure the safety of the families here at home.
Hundreds also weighed in on her Facebook page. Many were adamantly anti-refugee and showed no signs of hospitality. Murkowski says she understands that reaction, too, after watching the horrible events in Paris on Friday. Senator Dan Sullivan said in a Facebook post that the government needs a rigorous system to verify identities of asylum seekers before the U.S. can accept any Syrian refugees. Congressman Don Young issued a similar statement. Catholic Social Services runs Alaska's refugee resettlement program. Executive Director Lisa Aquino says there are no plans to bring Syrian refugees to Alaska. Aquino says she understands people are afraid, but she hopes Alaska will continue to be a welcoming place for refugees.
I know that there's some people that are talking from a place of fear right now, and I understand that as well. And we want to hear everyone's comments. We are part of this community, and we want to hear from everyone. But what I see is so much love and support for fellow people here in Anchorage.
Aquino says 125 refugees are expected to be resettled in Anchorage this year, many from countries like Somalia and the Congo. President Obama, in a speech in Turkey, said the refugees are seeking security from terrorism. He said slamming the door in their faces would be a betrayal of our values. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a closer look at the investigation into a recent prison death in Juneau.
I don't know if you'd have lived otherwise, but I can tell you that it's unacceptable what happened in terms of the interaction and the fact that help wasn't called.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news about Alaska businesses and industries for over 30 years. News, information, and subscriptions are available online at akbizmag.com. The Alaska Marine Conservation Council reminds Alaskans to choose local, sustainably caught seafood when dining out or in. More information at akmarine.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Marine Conservation Council.
A new report on the state's prison system details disturbing events related to the death of Juneau resident Joseph Murphy. In August, the 49-year-old Iraq veteran died of an apparent heart attack in a holding cell at Lemon Creek Correctional Center. He was being held there on non-criminal charges. At the time, Department of Corrections released scant information about the death. KTOO's Lisa Fu has more.
Dean Williams calls Joseph Murphy's death at the Juneau prison an incident gone wrong. Williams is special assistant to Governor Bill Walker. He spearheaded the three-month review of the Department of Corrections. Murphy died at Lemon Creek Correctional Center the morning of August 14. Night before, he was intoxicated and had been brought to the prison on a protective hold, not on criminal charges. Around 7 p.m. on August 13th, Murphy was put in a cell that had a video camera. Williams watched the footage.
It's compelling video. Very, very disturbing.
Williams and the review team used the video, which had no audio, and interviews with prison employees to piece together what happened. Murphy is seen awake at 5:20 the morning he died and doesn't appear to be intoxicated anymore, according to the report. About a half hour later, Murphy complains of chest pains to two different staff members. Both say they offered to call for medical help, but Murphy declined. 10 minutes later, a third staff member responded to Murphy banging on his cell door and yelling for medical care. A fourth staff member overheard what Williams calls a callous exchange.
Staff 4 hears the quote between staff 3 and the inmate is essentially saying, "I don't care if you live or die." And, you know, it's basically, "I don't really care." And staff 4 was real clear that's what he overheard. It's a credible report, and it's not refuted either.
Within 20 minutes of that exchange, the report indicates Murphy was sweating, paced the cell, and banged on the cell door. At one point, he's on his hands and knees. He stands and walks while patting his chest, then collapses and dies. He's not discovered in that condition for another 10 minutes.
I don't know if he would have lived otherwise, but I can tell you that it's unacceptable what happened in terms of the interaction and the fact that help wasn't called.
Williams says that third staff member was sanctioned, though not the level Williams deems appropriate. The report also finds fault with why Murphy was put in prison in the first place. State law allows for an individual who is incapacitated by alcohol or drugs in a public place to be put in temporary protective custody. Williams says it doesn't make sense to put medically unstable people in jail.
Just the whole practice of taking highly intoxicated individuals, some of that are detoxing, and placing them in a prison where they're going to receive far less attention is not a good plan.
The report shows incidents where people with a blood alcohol concentration 6 times the legal limit for driving under the influence are being dropped off at prisons. Murphy's that night was 0.165, about double the limit. Williams says the practice puts the prison system and the individuals at risk, and it's something that needs to change.
Protective custody was originally designed to be a last stop place for individuals, and somewhere along the line in the history of our state, it's become more of a middle of the road stop.
Williams says it's also misinterpreted by corrections. Instead of keeping an individual until they're no longer incapacitated or for a maximum of 12 hours, corrections treats the 12 hours as mandatory. Williams says the state may release the video footage of Murphy's death and 3 others the review team examined. Williams will be in Juneau this week to meet with Murphy's ex-wife and walk her through the footage. Her reaction and other family members will help inform the decision to release the videos. Williams says there isn't anything he or the state can do to bring Murphy back. but he's dedicating himself to make sure what happened to Murphy doesn't happen to anyone else. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
The Anchorage mayor announced the city's new homelessness action plan today. It will focus on providing 300 permanent housing units in the next 3 years for adults who are living on the street and in camps. KSKA's Ann Hillman found out more.
Mayor Ethan Berkowitz says the first step is coordinating with resource providers, landlords, and people who need housing to find and fill available units across the city, and eventually to build more. The effort will mirror successful plans from places like Utah. It includes a list of names of individuals to make sure people are getting the help they need. Berkowitz says that list also humanizes the problem.
It's very easy when you deal with policy to be anonymous and statistical and speak in abstraction. But when you identify individuals by name, it becomes more intimate and more personal, and it does that very quickly. And if we're looking for a house for someone whose name we know, it's going to make it easier for that to happen.
The municipality will also have a landlord liaison who will work directly with private landlords in case there are any problems with the tenants who are placed there. Berkowitz did not provide any specific mechanisms for funding the plan or a budget, but he says he wants to use money from agencies like the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. He also emphasized that housing people saves money because they are no longer using resources like emergency services. Berkowitz says it's not just a money issue, it's a moral issue.
But it's also important for the psyche of our city. So if we want to be a city that's vibrant and vital, we want to make sure that everybody who lives here is safe and secure.
This is not the first plan to end homelessness in Anchorage, but Mental Health Trust Authority CEO Jeff Jesse says this one is different.
Plans are no better than the people that are charged with carrying them out. And perhaps the most important thing about this effort is the leadership the municipality is showing in pulling together the funders, the providers, and as the mayor says, the entire community to find ways to address this issue.
Two elements of the plan are already in play. Rural Cap has 56 new Housing First units near Merrill Field, and the downtown soup kitchen will open at night as an emergency shelter for women starting at the end of the month. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It does such big things in our community and state, so help honor outstanding Alaskans for their philanthropy at the National Philanthropy Day and Alaska Luncheon on Friday, November 20th at the Dena'ina Center. Visit afpalaska.net. Philanthropy, big word, big state, big impact. This message sponsored by the Association of Fundraising Professionals Alaska Chapter and Alaska Public Media. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
An Alaska nonprofit wants to do something new, set up courts for about one-fourth of Alaska's tribes. The Association of Village Council Presidents, or AVCP, is a nonprofit representing 56 villages across the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, and they want each village to develop its own tribal court. Before they can do that, KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports AVCP has to develop a model for something that's never existed.
Tribal courts exist in the lower 48, but are rare in Alaska. There are 10 courts in the YK region. Monique Vondel Ricky is working to change that.
It's a really big order to fill, but it's part of history.
AVCP has tasked its Tribal Justice Center with developing a court in each of its 56 villages. Right now, Vondel Ricky is the director and sole member of the department. She comes from North Dakota, where she served as a tribal court justice for the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa Indians.
Through development of tribal court, you're saying we are empowering ourselves to be able to deal with our own issues, and it increases your exercise of sovereign immunity.
Tribal courts often deal with civil issues, like disputes between tribal members, between businesses and members, and between tribes and agencies. They handle child custody cases, adoptions, and juvenile cases. They also try and prosecute misdemeanors committed within the tribe's jurisdiction. The current hitch is that in Alaska, lands can't be taken into trust, which makes it impossible to secure federal funding to run tribal courts. But AVCP is moving forward anyway, with the hope that Governor Walker's administration will drop the lawsuit fighting trust status. AVCP received a multi-million-dollar federal grant that allows the Bureau of Indian Affairs to fund the court assessments without taking lands into trust. Last month, Vondel Rickey and a group of consultants from the Lower 48 traveled to two YK villages, Emonik and Kangiganuk, to begin creating the model, which they'll roll out at the annual BIA's Provider Conference in Anchorage this December. Again, Vondel Rickey.
The plan is that once we have this assessment model tool designed, then the BIA can take that to the other nonprofit organizations that represent tribes in Alaska and do the same thing there. So their turn will be coming.
Vondel Rickey hopes the assessments will begin in January.
I'm looking for updated constitutions, updated tribal codes, the caseload of each court that's in existence already.
She also wants to begin training court judges, clerks, and staff, as well as law enforcement and tribal council members at that time. Vondel Rickey hopes the 56 assessments will be completed by late 2018. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
For years, scientists have documented changes in Alaska's vegetation due to a warmer climate. Now, researchers are noting animals establishing new habitats on the North Slope in response to the altered landscape, KUAC's Robert Hannon reports.
Ken Tape is an Arctic ecologist at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He says his research often takes him to the North Slope, and he's reported on how shrubs in the region have responded to warmer temperatures and longer summers. They're thriving, growing taller, and moving across the landscape along rivers. It occurred to him those conditions favor moose, and, as it turns out, hares. He says that got him thinking.
If this change is as dramatic as we think it is, if we look back in the past, maybe there won't be any moose in these shrub patches. And as it turns out, that's exactly what I found when I, started looking through the literature a century ago. They weren't there.
Tape says his research, which appears in the journal Global Change Biology, focused on the hares because hunting presents complications when modeling moose populations. Nevertheless, it's clear where there are few or no animals in the region before, now they have clearly established habitats, complete with predators, says Tape, since lynx seem to have followed the hares.
We sometimes use the phrase formerly boreal wildlife expanding along these riparian corridors because it's true. Up until recently, the snowshoe hare, moose, those were strictly boreal species.
Moreover, Tape adds, it's remarkable how quickly the new habitats were developed. He says it will be interesting to see what happens over longer timescales. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
The northern lights are bright all over Alaska this winter, and those with a little luck, knowledge, and patience can keep their views all year long. KDLL's Jenny Nyman has more.
It's 10:30 Tuesday night in a parking area below the Warren Ames Memorial Bridge over the Kenai River. The lights of Kenai twinkle to the north, but the only immediate light comes from the occasional passing car and the sporadic burst of a flashlight clicked on to check camera settings by a handful of people gathered by the riverbank. It's a nice November night, clear and cool, but not frigidly cold. Even better, the aurora is starting to heat up.
And it looks a little bit like white up there, like it does a lot of times. And the forecast for tonight is hot, so I'm kind of excited.
Kenai photographer Mark Pearson is leading an impromptu workshop on aurora photography. Nothing formal, just a few people who jumped at the convergence of a clear night, active aurora forecast, and a knowledgeable professional to show them how to capture it. But Pearson speaks from experience in cautioning that an active forecast isn't a guarantee of a good show.
The aurora is fickle, and you never know exactly what it's going to do. And I've been out here in the same spot before and just had the sky explode. In 5 minutes, it's all over. And then someone shows up, and I'm like, you should have been here 10 minutes ago. You missed it.
The budding photographers, Bruce Hardesty and Anna Joy Babcock, are undeterred by the so far lackluster luminescence. They've got tripods and remote shutter releases to take long exposures, making the camera better able to see the aurora than they can with their own eyes.
We don't see it right now, but you took a picture and there's a color. How's that happen?
Well, because you have a lot longer exposure, your eye can't pick up the color that your camera will with a longer exposure. So you're getting all the light over 30, over 50.
So even if you can't see it, if you see a streak and you take a picture of it,
even if you can't see it, the camera can tap.
Some nights, patience is the hardest part of getting a good aurora photo, just waiting for the lights to flare up. When they do, you have to be ready. Pearson advises getting all your gear prepared before you head out. Make sure your battery is charged and bring a spare. Hook up your tripod mount and remote shutter release. And dress in lots of layers with hand warmers and a hot drink at the ready. Most importantly, know how to operate your camera in manual mode. Automatic settings just aren't going to cut it. Sorry, smartphone camera users, an Aurora selfie isn't going to work.
Three things you need to know to take a good Aurora picture, any good picture, and that's shutter speed, aperture, and ISO. And if you understand those three things, you can pick up any camera anywhere and you can use it and you can take spectacular pictures, and your imagination is your only limit.
A tripod is essential for low-light, long-exposure photography to minimize image blur from jostling the camera. Once your camera is stable, frame your shot. It could be just the night sky, or aimed lower toward the horizon, with trees, buildings, or other imagery in the picture, like, in this case, the bridge and the river below it. Next, set your focus. If you aren't somewhere completely remote, find a light in the distance and autofocus on that, then set your focus to manual to lock in the setting. Anything over about 40 feet is infinity to the camera, so focusing on a far-off earthbound light will work for lights in the heavens as well. After that, it's just a matter of watching and waiting.
Oh yeah, there's some ribbons starting to show a little bit there, a little
That's
straight.
What we see at our house, just like that, but no colors.
The lights weren't super bright yet, so they shot to make the most of the dim green glow. Aperture at f2.8, shutter speeds of 15 to 25 seconds, and ISO set to 800.
And then go ahead and take a picture.
Just press it, right?
Yep, just press it. Yep, and then take your hands off so we're not moving the camera. Got the cars going across the bridge, which would be great in your shot.
The Aurora is just passing the high point in its 11-year activity cycle, meaning all this winter should offer good opportunities for viewing and practicing the art of photographing the Northern Lights. This group was already getting the hang of it.
How's that, Mark?
Anna Joy, that's a world-class picture right there. That is spectacular.
I have my first Aurora picture.
Yeah, good job. Show Bruce.
Oh, that is beautiful.
That's a gorgeous picture.
Oh, yeah.
That's
great.
One you can hang on your wall right
and
there.
And see, you've got those lights down there that kind of light up that whole area. And
the Aurora forecast for the week is active Tuesday and Wednesday and moderate Thursday and Friday. To see the forecast, visit the University of Alaska Fairbanks Geophysical Institute website. In Kenai, I'm Jenny Nyman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholz and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Lisa Fu in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, and Jenny Nyman in Kenai. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to having conversations that help businesses and individuals succeed financially, because an open dialogue can open doors. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, an Alaskan company providing lifting and rigging products since 1983, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.